guys? Welcome to Birdwatch, New Orleans Pelicans podcast, powered by NOLA.com. I am here today with hibernating Pelicans columnist Scott Kushner.
Hello. Can you hear me? Am I hibernating? Am I furloughed? Am I hiatus? Whatever you'd like to call in my unpaid current conditions. I am here for you, Christian.
I think I hear a little Kushner too, right?
Yeah. I'm currently walking a baby around Broadmoor. So if you hear some sounds of excitement and or crying, it's not about the Pelicans, I promise.
So for those that don't know, you and JJ Redick's sons go to the same preschool, is that right?
Yeah, I guess you can call it preschool, sure. They actually don't go to the same one now. They will be at the same one in August, if all goes to plan, assuming things reopen at some point in our lives.
So there's a chance in 14 years, assuming this pandemic is blown over, that we see a Kushner-Redick backcourt at Newman High School.
It's possible. It's definitely possible. It's unlikely, but it's possible.
State champs, baby. I would love to see that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the genetic makeup favors one of those scenarios far better than the other.
So today we're going to be handing out some awards. The season isn't officially over, but at least the regular season, it's really starting to feel that way. Chinese Basketball Association, there's some news today. They stopped playing in late January, and they announced today that they're not coming back till July at the earliest. It's just not looking good for the regular season to resume. Adam Silver said that he's not going to make any decisions about the next step until May at the earliest, but it sure sounds to me like it's going to be a while, and I'm not very optimistic. I gotta be honest, Scott.
It doesn't seem like there's any purpose in playing the rest of the regular season. I mean, with the exception of a handful of teams in the bottom of the West who are going to get slaughtered by the Lakers in the first round anyway, what's really the point of, you know, playing the rest of these games except for money? And I think the money is far more weighted toward the playoffs than it is toward the regular season anyway. So just go ahead and skip the rest of this, get to the playoffs, and hopefully play something. And I mean, I'd be all for like a single elimination, all 30 teams, you know, stagger it out like the Big East tournament does or something, and find a way to make it so everybody's involved. But it does seem like there's a lot more logistics involved when you make it from 16 teams to 30 teams. And this is all very unprecedented, so it's really hard to tell what direction they really want to go.
A single elimination tournament, you could crush that up and inject it directly into my veins. That would be awesome. The quarantine tournament.
Yeah, and you stagger it out and have, you know, 15 in the West play 14, and then the winner of that plays 13. So you can make it so it's almost like a gauntlet match kind of thing, so that you actually do reward the best teams. And then once you get to 8, then you have a regular, you know, best 2 out of 3 or whatever you want to call it. But there can be a way to get everyone involved, take the regular season standings into account, but give everyone a chance. I just don't know if they have the time or the wherewithal or really the desire to have, you know, the Knicks have 3 weeks of training camp and show up to Vegas for something and then lose in one day. You know, it's like, is it really worth it to do all that? I don't know, but I know it's a possibility.
Yeah, and even if something like this, you know, were to happen, a single elimination, or maybe they go, you know, like a best of three to just try and determine some champion and have some record of the result of the season, I don't think that it would be played in front of fans. I mean, you read the stuff that the medical experts are saying right now, and, you know, many of them feel that we're not going to see, you know, games in front of large crowds or concerts or anything like that until fall 2021. I mean, people are saying that, you know, we're likely going to have a vaccine created before stuff like that is happening.
Yeah, I saw the CEO of Live Nation, Ticketmaster, today basically said their thought process is there's not going to be any ticketed event that they know of until next summer, so summer 21. That was depressing to hear, for sure, because that's, you know, such a large chunk of time. But you know what? A lot of people have been wrong a lot of stuff with this in both directions. You know, in February, we all were kind of scoffing and laughing at this thing. And then a month ago, we thought, you know, like the model showed 1 million people were going to die, and now it's at 60,000. So it's really hard to predict what's going to happen. I think if we've learned anything, it's that you kind of have to wait and see where testing goes, where the science goes, where social distancing goes. And and kind of, you know, base it off of new developments, off of data. And so, you know, projecting things out to summer of 2021 seems a little bit foolish with everything we've experienced here in the last 6 weeks.
Yeah, I would agree. I you know, feel strongly that we won't see sports in front of large crowds until like football season at the earliest.
Sure.
But that's as far as I'm willing to go right now. So, okay, before we get into the awards, there's just a little bit of news to go over, and that is J.J. Polk, a salary cap expert with the Pelicans, has decided to leave the team for the Bulls to work over under Arturnis Karnasovas. I just thought I would speak to this just because, you know, at one, anybody you talk to in the league, J.J. has a really good reputation. I think this is, you know, a fairly significant loss for the Pelicans. And I also think I could speak to Arturnis Karnasovas, you know, what type of guy he is, why that job might have been attractive. You know, I spent three seasons in Denver covering the Nuggets, and Arturnis is basically the number two there. Arturnis is a bright guy. I know you know Tim Connolly, who's in the New Orleans front office a little bit, but I'm excited to see what Arturnis builds in Chicago. When I was in Chicago for the All-Star game, they have great fans, man. And it just felt like, man, if you just give them a halfway decent product, this city would just explode. Like, they're going crazy over a terrible, hopeless team. And now they have a little bit of hope. I could see why that was an attractive situation for JJ maybe to go to.
For sure. And it's the connections run really deep for JJ and Arturnis, with Tim being the link between them. But it's a really good job. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, it's an associate GM role. JJ was kind of a holdover from Del Demps' staff. He'd been here for a long time, but he's really good friends with Tim Connolly, and therefore those guys are very connected, obviously, with Arturnis. So it all makes a lot of sense. It's disappointing, I think, for the Pelicans, but it also it checks out. You know, JJ is a terrific person as far as the people that I know on that staff and knew on Del Demps' staff. And, you know, I really don't say that about a lot of guys when it comes to this stuff, because you just don't know. Like, I try very hard not to say, oh, this is such a good dude, he's whatever. Like, we've seen how that can get people in trouble really fast. Like, I've known JJ Polk for a while. I've been around him and his family, and he's a good guy, and he has a sterling reputation for a reason. And he is going to be missed. I don't know if you'll see a single win or single loss affected by it, but it is, it's a great move for him. It makes a lot of sense. He's from that area of the country. He went to school for law school up around there. So a lot of it makes sense. It is disappointing, I think, for the Pelicans in some regard, but I think we're going to see a shakeup on that staff. David Griffin kept so many guys from Del Demps' staff because they were all under contract. So he kind of gave most of them a chance. And so we'll see whether or not they actually end up sticking around, or if you start seeing an exodus of a lot of those guys.
Yeah, that'll be really interesting to watch, you know, what kind of does happen with some of those guys who were working under Dell before Griff came in. I mean, you know, I think that period, as much as anything, was a chance for a new regime to kind of evaluate some of the holdovers, see what he had. So I think that's definitely something to monitor.
They were on guaranteed contracts. There was no harm in keeping them and give everyone a chance, which I thought was, you know, a fair move on David Griffin's part. It's like, you don't just step in and burn the house down, which is what a lot of people do. He kind of gave everyone an opportunity to show what they can do. And I think, you know, naturally, as contracts run out and opportunities come up, particularly with so much linkage between Denver staff and Chicago staff now, there's going to be a lot of opportunities for those guys.
Yeah, Griff did a conference call last week with local media. You know, there's not a whole lot new to report, to be honest. I thought, you know, one of the interesting things to come out of it was he was asked, you know, if the regular season is indeed over, do you consider it a success? And he basically said that on the court, largely no. I mean, the 28-36 record, not what they wanted, although injuries were a big factor in that. Off the court, he said, yes, it was a success. He felt like they did change the culture. He pointed to things like your JJ Redick and Zion Williamson stepping up and donating to help people who are impacted by COVID-19. I don't know. I thought it was kind of an interesting answer. I mean, do you agree with that? That, you know, they didn't get the results they wanted, but like things did change here.
Can we say that sounds like they're, you know, poking at the coaching staff a little bit, right?
I think it could be interpreted that way.
That's an underhanded way. No, I wouldn't even say underhanded. I think it might just be an honest interpretation from Griff of what he feels is that a team that he thinks was maybe more talented than the actual achievements on the court. Now, of course, injuries play a role in it. You know, some opportunities that slipped away, particularly in those last couple of weeks, even as things were getting better, they had games that they probably, you know, certainly that Minnesota game that you should have won and lost, things of that nature. But I think it's safe to say that there's enough dissatisfaction that they're not going to hold everything in place going into next year. And that is enough to be newsworthy in its own right, is just the idea and that foreshadowing that you can kind of point to that if there's changes, because it's pretty clear he feels that the roster is on the right track and that they have a whole lot of pieces in place to be a contender, and they weren't really close to that this season.
Yeah. Hey, I have a question. This is Jeff, longtime listener, first time caller. Would you all say, if you had to make it, like, do you think the shutdown, if they're going to make sweeping changes, do you think the season just cutting off kind of helped the situation in terms of coming back and running it back again, or hurt the situation in terms of this just gives them a clean slate to just start fresh?
It's still too early to tell. I mean, we just have to see whether the regular season is going to come back or not before, you know, they can make any decisions, or they're willing to make any decisions. I don't think they're going to make any decisions when they don't know.
I do think it provides them cover, though, that if they had made the playoffs, it would have been a lot harder to make moves, you know, similar to what we saw in 2015, where they kept saying, you know, if they had missed the playoffs that year, that Dell and Monty would have both gotten fired kind of on the spot. And instead, they made the playoffs and that allowed everybody to kind of keep going. Just because it's hard to make sweeping changes on a team that makes the postseason when that their goal was to make the postseason. So I do, in some regard, it's going to allow them a little more freedom to say, okay, here's the record. We're not looking at the record from, you know, January 1 on or Christmas on. You can say, look, this is what we did, and we was not good enough, and it wasn't even really that close. I mean, it felt like it was close because their schedule was so soft to the end of the season, but they really weren't that close to making the playoffs if the regular season ends, you know, now.
Yeah, I mean, they had 18 games left. Of those games, they played three teams with winning opponents. I mean, yeah, I mean, 3.5 games, like, that's not, you know, insignificant. But I really do think if they played it out, it would have gone right down to the wire. I don't know if they would have made it or not, but it felt like it was coming right down to the wire. But, no, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, for sure. And again, we're like, that's the way the schedule was set up allows us the hypothetical to think that it was going to get that close. When you look at it like, okay, the season just, you know, stop it right now. 3.5 games out of 8 is not a particularly great season, or is anything that's worth keeping anybody around for that you don't 100% trust.
Yeah, for sure. I'm gonna spoil this one right now. I was gonna save this one, but one of the things I wanted to ask you was just the most disappointing aspect of the season in general. I would say this was New Orleans issues during crunch time. You know, you wrote about this a lot. They went 12-24 in games that were within 5 points at any point during the last 5 minutes. To me, that was, you know, maybe the number one issue right up there with, you know, I guess you could say injuries. Every team has injuries. The Pelicans especially did so, of why they were disappointing was they competed in a lot of these games, and especially after they got out of that 13-game losing streak. But you know, whether you want to put it on coaching, whether you want to put it on young players, they just couldn't win close games.
Yeah, I would say that's easily the most disappointing factor for this season. If they even go 500, you're talking about an entirely different scope of what the year looks like. But I do point to injuries. I think that is the most disappointing thing, because you brought in this whole new training staff. You spent tons of investment. And this was the call year after year after year, was the Pelicans are not investing in this stuff. And it's you know, an organizational issue is the reason that they're you know, losing more games to injury than any other team in the league. And then they do everything that anybody's ever asked them to do. They brought in the trainer that has, you know, all this hype and fanfare around him and has been praised by players left and right. They throw millions of dollars into the facility. There's nothing more they seemingly could have done. And then they lose basically the exact same amount of games to injury as they've ever lost. I mean, it was no different than any of the past Pelicans teams. You know, you had a couple weeks there where they weren't totally injured, but, you know, games that were won, the injuries that you thought were one or two games were four or five, you know, thinking of Brandon Ingram. And it's disappointing. I don't know who you blame it on, but it's definitely, I think, the most disappointing factor is everyone sort of thought entering, you know, when they hired Nelly and they went through that process, that it was like, okay, we're over this era of the injured Pelicans who are cheap. And instead it was like, well, now you have the injured Pelicans who are not cheap. And it's a lot harder to diagnose the problem when you've done all the things that everyone's always asked for.
Yeah. And look, you could just like look at like the total number of games they lost this year. It is a huge total. I don't know that like you can evaluate or make sweeping conclusions about, you know, a new training staff like 1 year in. I think that's a thing that you look at over like a 3 year or a 5 year period. Like if
sure,
they're still having these same issues in like, you know, two seasons from now, then you're like, man, like, what did we make all this investment for? But you know, like,
oh yeah, especially it's not to say that the investment was wasted or stupid or done anything wrong. It's just like, it didn't matter. Like in this season, it did not make any dent. I think that on its face is disappointing.
Yeah, it just sucks. It just sucks. Okay. Well, Kushner, I want to ask you about some of the positives. I know that you have been waiting to hand out superlatives. That's I can sense the excitement. So let's just start with the big one. I actually think this is a pretty obvious answer, but who would you say the MVP of this team was this season?
Probably Brandon Ingram. I would say he was their best player more nights than not. I think he was the steadiest offensive performer. I think he had, you know, a huge growth, which was so uplifting to them. You know, Drew Holiday was up and down for so much of the year, and Zion didn't play except for, you know, what was the final number on his amount of games?
2019.
Yeah, 2019. So, you know, I don't think there's any way you can name someone else as the team's MVP. And Brandon Ingram was an all-star. So let's not forget that. And that's a pretty objective distinction to say that he was their best player this year.
Yeah, I think it was clearly Brandon Ingram. You just don't often see guys who've played three seasons in the NBA change their shot profile like Brandon Ingram changed his this year. I mean, he was taking two threes a game in LA, and all of a sudden he's taking more than six a game here. He's knocking them down 38-39%. If you just look at like, you know, the percentages you shot at the rim in the mid range, they're pretty much the same. Like this rise in efficiency was almost purely due to him being able to knock down threes and the free throw line too. So huge credit to him for, you know, working on that jump shot, and to Fred Vincent for helping him tweak it. And I just think he was the most consistent player too. Like even Brandon Ingram's bad games were still pretty good. I remember, you know, the game in Memphis on Martin Luther King Day, he had 25, and it felt like it was kind of a meh performance. And I remember him kind of joking around in the locker room afterwards, because that one started at like 1:30. He was like, man, if that game had started at 8, I would have had 50. That's kind of what's this season was like for Brandon Ingram. Like, even the bad games, he was still able to go out and get you 20, 25 and, like, do it fairly efficiently.
Yeah, the big question, though, and while the optimism can obviously run wild of looking at the numbers and remembering those moments and remembering those games, like, you know, the Utah game and things like that, you know, he did not look to be the same all-star player when he was next to Zion. And that is the biggest question, I think, entering the future for these guys, because these are going to be the two cornerstones of this franchise, as far as we know, you know, unless something happens to the lottery or, you know, a massive trade takes shape. The plan right now on paper is it's Zion and Ingram's team. And until you see different, I think you have to get, you know, a little bit better chemistry between those two guys in order to feel really comfortable about that being your future. But the good news of that side is that when Zion did come back, Lonzo Ball played significantly better on the other side. So who's more important? It's hard to say. You know, your three pieces kind of yo-yoing up and down. But I do think while Brandon Ingram was their best player, to just say out and out, like he's a star and that's it, is maybe thinking about it a little too optimistic.
Yeah, I mean, I don't feel confident that he's going to make the All-Star game next year or anything like that. But I guess I was a little bit higher on how he looked when Zion did come back. I thought they looked pretty good after those first three games when, you know, both were kind of doing the your turn, my turn thing. I don't know. I thought they had decent chemistry. And I think, you know, if you look at Ingram's numbers, like those last 14 games, like they were pretty good. They weren't what he was doing before. I don't know. I'm actually pretty optimistic about that pairing. Maybe more so than a lot of Pelicans fans are. I just think it works. I mean, I think Ingram, the one thing that you could say is like, sometimes he does get a little ball stoppy. And I think that's, you know, one of the things that the frustrated Pelicans coaching staff at times was they want the ball to keep moving. They don't want it to stick, and it can sometimes with him. So I would say, you know, one of the things that I'm looking for is he is a very good isolation scorer, but just to keep the flow of the offense moving. And that'll be one thing I'll monitor going forward, I guess, him and Zion.
Yeah, I think there were some nights where it just didn't look good. I mean, I'm trying to remember, was it Minnesota where he was like 2 for 16, or, you know, there was some
yeah,
pretty ugly
stinker against Miami. Yeah.
Yeah. There, I mean, there were some very bad performances when he was next to Zion. And again, it's not to say it's indicative of everything, but you know, you take his season as a whole, I don't think you can project his future on this team based on the season as a whole. I think you need to project his future more so on what he did next to Zion, because that's going to be more important than anything else. And that was really what this whole season was supposed to be about. It wasn't even supposed to be about making the playoffs. It was just supposed to be about finding the pieces that fit next to Zion. And it's pretty damn clear they got one, which is Lonzo Ball, who is very obvious, a great fit next to Zion. And then Brandon Ingram, who is a really good scorer and someone who can do a whole lot of stuff for you, and someone who's improved greatly. But whether or not he's capable of being a number two guy, if you want to get to that level, is still a question in my mind.
Yeah, I think that's fair. You know, the Pelicans are very honest that, you know, Ingram still has a ways to go on the defensive end too. So moving down the list, best offensive player, I don't think we need to spend much time on that. It's Ingram, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, for all the reasons we just mentioned, I mean, if Zion had played more games, maybe he's a candidate for that. But it was pretty clearly Ingram just because of the amount of games. Best defensive player, I actually had to think about this one a little bit. I part of me wanted to go with Derek Favors. I gave real consideration just because I think that a good interior defender is almost more valuable than a very good perimeter defender. I mean, you just look at like what the Pelicans did on defense, you know, when Fave came back from dealing with his mother's death, they were kind of a different team. And part of that was a schematic thing, but I think Fave was huge. But I don't know. Ultimately I went with Drew Holiday, just because he's such a stud. I don't know. I was kind of torn on this. What would you say?
I would actually say Favors. And I don't think Derek Favors is, you know, a long-term piece or anything like that. Or even, you know, I'd be surprised if he's back next year. But I think that showed that someone like him at center is important for this team, even doing whatever they want to do defensively, because they were fouling everyone for the first few months of the season. Anytime a team crossed inside the three-point line, which was relatively easy, they were usually getting fouled if they got to the rim. And then once he kind of came back and got his legs underneath him, and, you know, he went through a grieving process with his mother. He went through an injury in the preseason. So it took a while to get going, and his numbers were not really impressive at all as far as rebounding, all that stuff. But he did a lot of selfless things defensively that made this team, you know, at least mediocre on defense as compared to being abjectly terrible, which they were, you know, the first 6 or 8 weeks of the season. So I think just that alone, for me, makes him the defensive MVP. Drew's performance this year to me was just uneven. He just never felt like he was in the same, you know, place the whole year. It was like week to week, you didn't know what Drew Holiday you were getting. And he brings it defensively most nights, and he has an incredibly difficult assignment most of the time. But I didn't think he was as good this year as he'd been in the past. And perhaps that was because he was covering up a lot of holes in a lot of other places that Anthony Davis maybe used to help with. But it really did not seem to be that same level of caliber for Holiday. But perhaps I was just grading him on a curve.
Yeah, you know, I think that's interesting. I think that Drew is probably he's the better defender in a vacuum and like, you know, in a playoff matchup or whatever, like the highest stakes, Drew is clearly the best defender on this team. But I think one of the reasons why Favors was so noticeable is because who his backups were. Like, if Favors wasn't in there, it was like Jackson Hayes or Ja Okafor, who are just bad defenders too. I think that's part of it, right?
Yes, it was definitely bad. And I think, you know, I do think Ingram being a below average defender did not help things for Drew, because he ended up having to guard a lot of wings and a lot of bigger guys. And then, you know, when he was on the floor with JJ Redick, that also did not help. And, you know, I don't think there was I don't know. It's always hard to judge defense because it's a team thing. And so the only thing that I can really judge it off of is when Derek Favors got back on the floor, they stopped being horrible. And they were horrible even when Drew was playing early in the season.
It is such a team thing. It's like, I think it's almost more of like, how do you move five guys move as one rather than like, do you have good individual defenders at every position?
Yes. And that was what the Warriors did so well, right? It's not like Steph Curry is some incredible defender, you know, or they had a couple of really good defensive pieces, but they moved five as one so well for so many years that it really, you know, it made those guys who were good really, really good, because the other pieces knew where to be and knew where to help and knew how to fill in gaps. And, you know, the first year with this thing, I mean, those first couple of weeks, I mean, is that the worst defense you've ever seen? It's the worst defense I've ever seen.
The worst defense I've ever seen. I don't know. I mean, I had a sister who played on like the C team in middle school.
It was pretty bad. A lot of bad college teams. I covered Tulane for several years. They were not that bad on defense as the Pelicans were this year. I mean, it was a joke. It was every possession. You were like, okay, they're going to dribble through the 3-point line without any problem. And then they're going to get to the rim and they're going to get fouled. And it was every single possession, and you're giving up, what, like 130 a game, and trying to play as fast as humanly possible. It was beyond logic. And then they started making tweaks, and the tweaks happened as they got healthier, and then, you know, some things came in place. So it's not like all was lost, but they were really – I mean, I think people kind of forget just how bad they were. I mean, they were 7-23. They were a really, really bad basketball team for a pretty long period of time.
Yeah, right at the end of that losing streak, they were third to last in defensive efficiency in the league. I've seen some bad defense too. I went to Mizzou during the Kim Anderson era.
They had a first team all defense player. And they were 28th in defensive efficiency. It's not like, you know, some of these teams that were intentionally losing. This was they had some real talent. The Lonzo Ball's not a bad defender either, and they were just getting torched every single game.
Not what you want, Kush. What they do at center this summer is going to be so interesting, because, I mean, not only do they have to look at their starting center position, I certainly don't think that Jackson Hayes is ready to step into that role. You know, they could bring back Derek Favors. They could go another route. But, like, man, if they want to be a team that, like, tries to win a playoff series, I think I don't know. I guess you just roll with Zion during like really important games, the backup five. But like, I like Jackson Hayes. I think he's an interesting prospect, but like, he's not ready to contribute to winning basketball right now.
No, but you see so many flashes from him that you like his upside, and that if he gets minutes, there are things on there that you would think just time would make him better at. You know, Anthony Davis is a terrible defender his first really 2 years, and then he started figuring it out, and it's like, oh, this guy has insane ability. Once he kind of gets the reps and gets the time, like, he eventually figured it out. And I don't know if that's the case for Jackson Hayes, but I know that's why he was picked where he was picked. It wasn't because he was ready to do it right now. It was because you can't teach the ability that he has when it comes to jumping and his length and his athleticism and like those things. But yeah, he is not ready from a understanding, you know, what teams are trying to do to him on a possession-by-possession basis. Because, yeah, I mean, we've also seen guys like Ja Okafor who the league just kind of passed him by. And Jackson Hayes is the future of what a center is going to look like as far as his build and his abilities, his talent level. But right now, mentally and from a basketball IQ perspective, he's just not there yet. But they do need another, you know, what they do with Derek Favors will be one of the bigger storylines of the offseason. First of all, because what the heck is that guy worth in this environment? Like, we have no idea what anybody's worth. So all these, the Pelicans front office is like drilling through all this stuff to try to figure out what all these guys are worth. Nobody even knows what the salary cap's going to be anymore.
Right.
So it is, it's really like, it's kind of an insane experiment to see. Not only do you try to figure out what you need and what you value and what you prioritize, then on top of that, you really have no clue what anybody is worth anymore because the whole system has been turned upside down.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, moving on to best individual performance. I actually think this one is pretty clear too. I considered a couple of Jrue Holiday's best games, but I think ultimately it has to be Brandon Ingram's 49-point game in the win over the Jazz. I recently rewatched that one. Ingram went 15-25 from the field. He got to the line 20 times, 6 assists, some nice passes in overtime. What struck me in that one was him just going at Gobert over and over. He had that crazy, like, reverse dunk on him. I thought that was pretty clearly the best performance of the year. And I think that, I don't know, maybe Zion's debut game, it was maybe right up there with the most fun game I attended this year.
Yeah, Zion's debut was definitely the most fun. And that Brandon Ingram was the first game where I was like, oh, they've got like a real home court. Like when they want it, you know, like when they play to the level, like people are really into this team. Like they do like them. And that was, you know, I think a really important moment. I wrote all this down, but now that I'm, you know, walking with my son and not have anything in front of me, there was a game where Zion had like, what did Zion have? Like 32 on like 16 shots or something. I mean, he had some performances that were really impressive. And it wasn't just that he was 19. It was that he was just, he got fouled every single time he got the ball down low and was scoring all the time. And he is, his free throws obviously aren't spectacular, but he gets the line so often. And there was a couple nights there where it was like, wow, this guy is going to be really tough to stop, and not just tough to stop when he's 24. He's tough to stop now, and those kind of nights, I think, made me. I think those were the better performances from a night to night basis because you saw the promise of what this guy has, and that he was able to deliver it, you know, at such a young age.
Yeah, he had a game this year where he had 35 points in 33 minutes. That was the home loss to the Lakers. I mean, just stupid production from him. Like, it was like a point a minute, a little under a point a minute. It came out to. I don't have it right in front of me. But
and now, granted, that Lakers team was without Anthony Davis that night, but Zion was still. It was incredible. Him and LeBron just kind of went back and forth. It was pretty impressive.
So, best win. This one kind of ties into what we just went over. I went with that overtime win against the Jazz. I mean, Ingram was phenomenal. Donovan Mitchell had his flamethrower out. He had 46. I thought it was the best win, too, because the Pelicans had just lost a really tough game to the Jazz and gotten screwed over by the officials. And then they got screwed over by the officials again. Ingram hits that fadeaway jumper with like 0.2 seconds left. And they call this foul the inbounds play. I thought, you know, Pelicans showed resiliency that they didn't often this season and pulling that one out in overtime. It was fantastic.
Yeah, that was a fun game for sure. I will take the Christmas Day beating Denver on the road in a game that when really everything seemed lost for the season. And they went out and sprung a really big upset on a big stage and did it in kind of dominant fashion. And it spurred on, their best basketball of the season and best basketball in a while. They were really good from, basically the game before that all the way up until, the end of the season. So that to me was such a turning point to be able to step up, to show that, hey, we don't suck. Like, I know our record says we suck, but we don't suck. And they didn't that night. They were really good and they carried it over and they got, a little bit of help here and there. Like, I think the Rockets came in a couple days later and they didn't have Harden or Westbrook. And then they played Indiana and beat them, at home. So there were some really good wins in that stretch right around the end of the year when their record was really bad. But that Denver win to me was the catalyst behind a lot of it.
Yeah, that's a pretty interesting one. I was there for that one. Ingram had 7 threes in that game. The only reason I didn't pick that one was Nikola Jokic looked like he ate like 3 Christmas hams before that game started. Like it didn't look real engaged to me. A little sluggish.
That's fair. That's fair. Considering like the game you picked, like Donovan Mitchell was like on fire and was in, prime Donovan Mitchell, and they still beat him anyway.
Yeah, the Pelicans got sad Jokic twice this year. The one they beat him at home, and and then the other one they got really good Jokic. Yeah, I can't wait to see what Jokic looks like after the pandemic.
Yeah, but on that Christmas game, I want to say they were like 9.5-point underdogs or something going on the road, like a night Christmas game, and they won handled. Like it was a, and from there they just kind of never looked back.
Yeah, I mean, Denver's just a really hard place to win, too. At the end of a long road trip, the altitude is such a factor all the time. Okay, we're going to go to the category I know you've been relishing, the worst loss of the season. I'm just going to cede the floor.
they lost most of their losses, especially the second half of the season when things got interesting. Most of their losses were to good teams. So it wasn't as if it was like a lot of things to kill them over. The Golden State loss, however, on the road when they dropped to 7-23, that was the one to me that was like, this is a joke. Like this team is not ready for prime time. This team has no ability to mesh with this philosophy. They can't do anything. And it was as bad as they could possibly look, in one night. And then they turned it around basically from that point going forward. But that to me was the lowest point of the season, was going on the road to a Golden State team that had no players. I mean, no players. And had you just broken this crazy long losing streak, the longest losing streak in franchise history, and then you show up against the worst team in the NBA and just lay an egg. And it just looked like the season was over. And that was when I called for Alvin Gentry to be fired. Sure enough, they went on to have an incredible stretch from that point forward.
Yes, that is an excellent good-bad candidate, arguably the low watermark. I went with the 46-point loss in Dallas. It was the worst loss from scoring margin in franchise history. I have never been in a locker room where no one wanted to talk before. I think Drew said a few words, and then it was me and Will Giller. We tried to get JJ to talk, and I got 2 one-word answers, and he just walked off. And it was very uncomfortable. I mean, very uncomfortable.
I've been a part of a few of those since covering this team.
Yeah.
That was horrible. Wasn't that afternoon game also?
It was a matinee game. Yeah, I think it was like a 1 p.m. starter or something.
It was, that was terrible. I wasn't there. I think I turned it off. I might not have turned it in for the second half, that one. It was pretty abysmal, and that one was terrible. And then trying to think of that Minnesota game late in the year. But Minnesota had won like what, two of their last 25 entering that one. And if it was one, the Pelicans needed to stay in the race and all this stuff. And they just were terrible. And it was one of those things they hadn't done the whole second half stretch, was just lay a complete egg, at, especially doing it at home against a team like that. And they just got absolutely worked by the Minnesota Timberwolves in a, you know, what's felt like a really big game at the time.
Yeah, the Malik Beasley game, or one of the Malik Beasley games.
That was okay. A Malik Beasley game for sure. The guy right. I was sitting next to was pretty excited about it.
I'm gonna throw you a curveball for this last one here, and then I'll let you get back to your family and your neighborhood. Who is the Pelican you'd most want on your side in a post-apocalyptic scenario?
Oh, man, that's tough. I think Drew is probably that guy, right? Like, Drew's got the quiet stoicism, but yet still has the strength and determination to not piss you off while at the same time protecting you. And so I think that would be my choice, is Drew Holiday. He's really, you know, any of the other guys, I don't see them being able to really back down the zombies. But Drew, I think would have a really good, a good perspective on the matter, and would really help you out as you went through the process. Now, he also just wouldn't require, you know, a lot of like conversation, which I think would be nice.
Okay. So quietness is a positive for you in this scenario. I was looking for guys who had outdoor skills. Like, are there any Boris Dio types on this team who camp and sail like that? And none came to mind. I don't know if Belly can.
The last one I remember is Dante Cunningham was the big outdoorsman, but I don't know if they've had one since then.
Okay, so there are no known outdoorsmen, so you're kind of just taking the shot in the dark. And when you're doing that, I just decided to go with somebody who would just scare off people, not by necessarily having a mean personality, but just their appearance. I just wanted to go with someone big and quiet. So I went with Derek Favors, just because I feel like if you just saw Derek Favors in the wild and you didn't know anything about him, you wouldn't be like, yeah, I'm not messing with this dude.
He looks brooding.
Yeah, brooding.
He's not, but he looks brooding. I would agree with that. Yeah, Dana, I wouldn't say this is a team full of candidates that you'd like to have with you in an apocalypse.
You know? That's fair.
Hey, Jeff again. I would like to say, don't forget about Kenneth Williams. He works harder than everybody else. He would grind out the zombie apocalypse.
He also says nothing.
Yeah, he would be very quiet, very low maintenance. He's the type of guy you want.
Oh my god, I would be covering Kenrich beating down the zombie apocalypse one by one, and Noah.com religiously.
Right, but just don't expect him to get him from far away. He's gonna have to come up close. He's gonna catch him off guard. Yeah.
Can we say who'd be the worst? Can we say it's JJ Redick? I think he'd be the worst. JJ I think he just requires a lot of the. I think he thrives off of the passions of life, you know. And you wouldn't have any of that in the zombie apocalypse. There would be no fine food, no good books to read, or you know, movies to watch. I really think he thrives on all the BS that we thrive on. And so he'd be pretty bad at that role.
But he could get him from real far away.
Yeah, he has very good vision. So if the vision is what we're looking for.
I'll tell you this. You're not going to be able to eat at the French Laundry during the apocalypse.
No, exactly.
That'd be tough for JJ.
Yeah, you need someone who really thrives on the simplest possible thing. So that's why I'm going with Drew.
All right, Kush. Well, thank you for doing this. Appreciate your son's contributions as well. He was great.
Sam over here crushed it. He's been in this stroller the whole time. So sorry if I was out of breath at points. I was trying to push this thing around neutral grounds and God knows what else.
Hey, I hope we're all here to see the Kushner-Redick backcourt here in a couple of years, okay?
Yeah, he'll be the student manager and JJ's son will be the All-State guard.
All right, Scott.
All right. See you, Christian.